He's bringing me back to something that I taught a little bit on during the conference. And it was based on a three-second vision that he showed me. And I still haven't come to the end of teaching on this. And I'm reminded of Pastor Dave getting a little three-second vision down the born-again trail and spending the next how many years teaching on a three-second vision. You know, there's no end to God. There's just simply no end to Him. He gives you revelation knowledge. You know, it comes in layers. So you get through with one layer and you're not done. I mean, you're just getting started real good. Then He's going to show you the next layer down. And that's what I feel like's happening with me is He's peeling the onion a little bit. And I'm getting to see a little bit more of this revelation. And when He shows you something out of the New Testament, one of the most exciting things is when He shows you the under the shadow, and you can see them together, and you can see that, yeah, it's exactly what I thought it was. And it gives you that the clarity under the shadow. And we're going to look at that a little bit this morning. For those of you that don't know what I'm talking about when I talk about this three-second vision, one day my wife and I don't remember what we were doing, but we were together, and I saw this just like that, this vision. And it was Adam in the garden, hadn't fallen to sin yet. He was right at that place where he was about ready to partake of that fruit. And as he was just about to take that bite, suddenly I saw a door open, and I saw him as he took that bite. He stepped through that door. And as he had that bite in his mouth, that door slammed shut. And as he went, turned around to look, it was gone. It was gone. It wasn't that it was just shut. The door was gone. It wasn't there anymore. He had stepped out of that position, his standing with the Father. It was gone forever for him. It was not there anymore. He couldn't find a way to get back in to that standing that he had in the garden with the Father. It was gone. And as I'm thinking about this now, and as he's been showing me some things, you know, we look at that experience, and it's Genesis chapter 3. We may look at a few scriptures, I don't know, but you can read it for yourself. You've looked at it a few times. Haven't you ever wondered, God, why didn't you give him, you know, like plan B? Because, I look at it through my eyes, and knowing, you know, what a mess I can be at times. And I think to myself, God, it would have really been nice if you would have had a plan B for Adam, knowing that Adam's going to make this mistake. Can you see the conversation? Okay, Adam, I know you're going to do this. I know you're going to make this mistake. So here, I'm going to give you this little pill. And when you make that mistake, and the name of this pill is I Can't Believe I Did It. That's the name of it. Once you do that, just take that little pill, and it's going to erase everything, and it's going to put you right back to where you were before. Now, for me, I want a bottle of those pills. Take me all the way back all the time. But he didn't do that. And I'm thinking, God, now this is really important. I don't want you to miss it. I'm thinking, God, you're God. You knew what was going to happen? How come you didn't have a plan in place already? You know what he said to me? I wasn't planning on his failure. I wasn't planning on his failure. When God tells you something, you'll notice what's missing is plan B. When he tells you, I want you to go here and do this, there isn't a plan B in there. It's simply go and do that. That's all I'm asking you to do, and I'm not giving you a plan B. There's no plan B. Just go do it. See, if God would have given him that little pill, there would have been a plan B. He would have been planning on Adam's failure. He's not planning on our failures. Get a hold of that. He's not planning on you making the mistakes. Thank God now where we are when we do make mistakes, He's put in place a way that we can repent and we can be corrected and we can get back on course again. But what I want you to realize is He doesn't come into this relationship with you looking at you like you're just one big mistake ready to happen. He doesn't look at you like that. Now, we may look at ourselves that way, but that's not the way your Father looks at you. Your Father doesn't look at you like you're just one mistake ready to happen after the other, and we better plan on something just knowing that He's going to screw up again. It's not that way. But I want you to know something else. When you make the mistakes, I want you to look at what happened. I want you to see, once Adam did make that mistake, the extent to which the Father went after us. Think about that. The extent to which He went to extend His hand to bring us back into the place that Adam, the first Adam, lost. That He Himself would come and join us in this physical body and pay the price on our behalf. And that brings me to the next thing that I've been has been rolling over inside of me. You know, for years, I dealt with a feeling like God was about half mad at me all the time. Anybody else ever felt that way? Be honest. You felt like God was just about half mad with you for the mistakes that you've made? I think most people deal with that, whether they realize it or not. I think it's one of those thoughts in the back of your mind. And a lot of times we look at the things under the old covenant, under the shadow. We misinterpret what they're saying. We try to apply ourselves to those situations and they don't make sense to us. And that's a problem. Well, we're going to look at a word called judgment. See, when He showed me that vision, He showed it to me out of John chapter 10. And so what I've been doing recently is looking through John, reading it. I told Tim yesterday, I said, I know I need to be writing, but all I want to do is sit and read this and keep reading it, because the more I read it, the more He's speaking to me. And so I sit and read, and the more that I read, the more this unfolds. So what I'm finding out of John, there's a couple of reoccurring themes there. One of them, you'll notice, he talks about the Passover. Three different times, he gives specific mention of it. I'm going to give those to you real quick. In John chapter 2, verse 13 was the first time he mentions it. The Jews' Passover was nigh at hand. You can just write these down. I'm going to go quickly over this part. The second one is John chapter 6, verse 4. And the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was nigh. And then the third one is John chapter 12, verse 1. Jesus, 6 days before the Passover. John is the only one that focuses so much on the Passover. So I want that to stay with you. The other thing that kept coming out was judgment. Now, I talked about this a few weeks ago. In John chapter 8, we see where the Pharisees went out and found a lady that was caught in the act of adultery. They brought her before Jesus. They wanted Jesus to judge her according to the law. We know what Jesus did. He knelt down. He wrote something. We don't know what it was in the dirt. Look, the people that were watching, they read what He wrote. One by one, from the oldest to the least, they walked out. And then Jesus said this to the lady. that was standing there. When Jesus had lifted up himself, this is John chapter 8, verse 10. When Jesus had lifted up himself and saw none but the woman, he said unto her, "Woman, where are those thine accusers? Has no man condemned thee?" She said, verse 11, she said, "No man, Lord." And Jesus said unto her, "Neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more." And then in verse 15, he said, "You judge after the flesh. I judge no man." Now that's important. I want you to hang on to that. In verse 16, "And yet if I judge, my judgment is true. For I am not alone, but I and the Father that sent me." And then I spoke on chapter 9 of John. Chapter 9 of John is where the man is healed that was blind from birth, healed on the Sabbath. Of course, the religious people were all up in arms because of it. They were upset because how dare Jesus actually heal somebody on the Sabbath day? We can't have any healing on the Sabbath day. They talked to the parents. "Do you know who this is? Do you know what happened to him?" Well, this was their answer. "We know he's our son. We can't deny that. And we know he was blind and now he's healed. We can't deny that. But how he did it, we have no idea." Because they knew if they would have said that it was Jesus, that they risked being cast out of the temple. Well, what did that mean? Well, to their mindset, being cast out of the temple mean I've lost my position with God. And they weren't willing to risk that. So I want you to look at the end of chapter 9. I want you to see a statement that Jesus made here. And see, this is where, you know, to me, I would get confused because I see this word judgment again. See, he said in chapter 8, the previous chapter, he said, "I judge no man." Well, now look what he says. In chapter 9, verse 39, and Jesus said, "For judgment I come into this world, that they which see not might see, and that they which see might be made blind." And I'm looking at that, I'm thinking, okay, now, chapter before, he said he doesn't judge any man. Now he's saying, "I came into this world for judgment." Now, that's confusing me. I want you to look at chapter 12 of John. So we looked at John chapter 8, John chapter 9. Now we're looking at John chapter 12. And I want notice, like I said, this reoccurring theme about judgment. I already showed you about the Passover, how it's reoccurring. Now we're seeing this theme about judgment and how it's reoccurring. So in John, I have it in here somewhere. I know I do. Chapter 12, we're looking at verse. Well, look at the first verse, and we see here. Notice how these are matching up now. John chapter 12, verse 1. Then Jesus, 6 days before the Passover. Now, there's nothing coincidental. You know, they didn't just happen to throw that in. It didn't happen to occur right at this time for no reason. I want you to look at verse 31. We'll look at verse 30. Jesus answered and said, "This voice came not because of me, but for your sakes. Now is the judgment of this world. Now shall the prince of this world be cast out. And I, if I be lifted up from the earth, I will draw all men unto me." Clearly, he's talking about the crucifixion. Now go down to verse 46. We'll start in 44. Same chapter, chapter 12 of John. Jesus cried and said, "He that believes on me believes not on me, but on him that sent me. And he that seeth me seeth him that sent me. I am come a light into the world, that whosoever believes on me should not abide in darkness. And if any man hear my words and believe not, I judge him not. For For I came not to judge the world, but to save the world. He that rejecteth me and receiveth not my words hath one that judges. It's the word that I have spoken. The same shall judge him in the last day. For I have not spoken of myself, but the Father which sent me. He gave me a commandment, what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that this commandment is life after everlasting. Whatsoever I speak, therefore, even as the Father said unto me, so I speak. Now look at how the next verse starts in chapter 13, verse 1. Now before the feast of the Passover. I just wanted to read that part right there. He's making a point here, talking about the Passover feast. And he's also talking about judgment. And we're looking at judgment, we're saying, is he judging us? I don't understand this judgment, because I look at the verse and the verse says he came here, he didn't come to judge a person. But then when we look in chapter 9, it looks like he is saying that he came here for judgment, to judge us. So what is this all about? He came for judgment. What does it mean? And see, that's just in line with chapter 10 of John. Chapter 10 is the one that I shared with you before, talking about the door. The door. How he became the door for us. Remember the vision I was telling you about? How as I watched Adam partake of that, I watched a door appear. I watched him step through this door. And I watched the door slam shut and disappear. And now I'm seeing in chapter 10 of John where it says that he is the door. He is the door. And it also goes on to say that he's the shepherd that walks through the door, that leads us in and out, where we find pastures. I had someone ask me that question. What does that mean, in and out? When you came from outdoors, you walked out of the outdoors and you walked in to this church building. When you receive the redemptive work of Jesus, you walk out of that place as that old man and in to the position of a child of God. You walk in and out at the same time. You can't be at the same place twice. You're not stranded between the two. You don't have one leg in and one leg out. You're either in or you're out. You're not both. It's not possible to be both. You're either in the first Adam or you're in the last Adam. You can't be both. And I felt that way for many years, because I never even knew if I was saved or not. I felt like I was both in the Lord and in the world. I didn't even know if I was saved. How many people today are sitting in a church building somewhere that same way? They don't even know if they're saved. Look, you're either in the first Adam, and if you're there, you better get saved. Because at the end, you'll stand before the judgment seat of Christ, and he's going to say, I offered this offering up. You didn't partake of it. There's only one thing that we can do, and that is going to be to send you to hell. There's no other way around it. Or you're going to stand before him and you're going to say, come in now, good and faithful servant. Come in to your reward. It's one or the other. Can't be both. So having said all of that, I want you to go back. We're going to look at Genesis, because this will be a good way to walk into what I want to share with you today. So go back to Genesis 3. What I want you to see out of Genesis 3, we're looking here at the encounter with Adam. I was thinking about this as I read through this. You know, so many times I would read through this in the past, and I would try to think how God must have felt right then. Here's Adam. Did exactly what he was not supposed to do. How did God feel? I'm sure there was disappointment. I'm sure there was heartache. But I don't believe that there was anger in God towards Adam. I don't believe that was there. I don't believe he looked at Adam with disdain, and because that's not God. God's love. God's love. So look at what happened here. And let's start in. Well, let's start reading at where the sin took place. Verse 6 of chapter 3. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. And the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And notice this. They sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. So they were clothing themselves right there. Verse 8. And they heard the voice of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord amongst the trees of the garden. And the Lord God called unto Adam and said unto him, Where art thou? And he said, I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was afraid, because I was naked and hid myself. And he said, Who told thee that thou wast naked? Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee, and thou shouldest not eat? And the man said, The woman, that's real nice. He just throw the woman right under the bus. The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat. And then she's going to pass the buck. Verse 13. And the Lord said unto the woman, What is this that thou hast done? And the woman said, The serpent, it's his fault. He beguiled me, and I did eat. And the Lord said unto the serpent, Because thou hast done this, thou art cursed above all cattle, and above every beast of the field. Upon thy belly shalt thou go, and the dust shalt thou eat all the days of thy life. And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. And as I've mentioned before, women, and this isn't a health class, but you all know this, they don't have seed, they have an egg. He's speaking here about the Redeemer. And I want you to notice this. I mean, it doesn't look like there has been any time at all, hardly, that's passed. And already, God is putting into place the plan of redemption. It wasn't like he waited a few years or, you know, until he got around to it. Immediately, the plan of redemption. So there wasn't a solution in advance, because he wasn't planning on Adam's failure. But immediately, once Adam fell, the plan of redemption began to be put into place. So I thought a lot about this as I was growing up. I thought, you know, God told them the moment they eat this that they're going to die. And I looked at that and I said, they're not dead. Of course, they were dead spiritually, but they were still standing there. So I've been thinking about this. You know, in a courtroom, there are times that the judge will render what's called a judgment. That judgment, for whatever reason, they're not able to enforce that judgment at that second. And there are different reasons why that can happen. I'm not a lawyer, but I've heard some things on TV. So time passes, and eventually things come into a line and the judgment can be rendered against the person. In this case, God prolonged that judgment against Adam. We see that he was dead spiritually, but what we're going to see here as we look in these next few verses is that there was a sacrifice that was made here to clothe man, and that's in verse 21. Unto Adam also, and to his wife, did the Lord God make coats of skin, and he clothed them. He's already offering. There was an animal that died here. That's how they were clothed. Blood was shed. God was the one doing the offering. God was the one that made these coats and gave it to them. They had a covering. What did that allow God to do? Prolong that judgment. Remember I said the word judgment reoccurred through John. And I looked at it and I tried to figure out, what were you doing, God? What were you doing, Jesus? Did you come here to judge us? No. Where it said in John chapter 9 that he came for judgment, he came to receive the judgment. He came so that that judgment could be executed in him. In him. Not in you. You're quiet, but that's really good news. That keeps you from paying the price for it in hell. He paid the price in himself. See, the Passover that I mentioned, the Passover. John talks about the Passover. John talks about judgment. All of this is painting a picture. It's painting a picture. And I looked at this and I said, okay, Lord. John chapter 10, you talk about becoming a door. Jesus, you became a door. You talk about the Passover. And all of a sudden it dawned on my lightning quick mind that there's something about the Passover here that I probably need to look at. So with that in mind, let's go back to Exodus. This is where we're going to see under the shadow the picture of John chapter 10. Now we're not going to read the entire account of all 10 of these plagues that came on Egypt. We are going to go through a few of these. And the reason why is because I've found that I finally understand this. I finally understand what God was wanting to accomplish in the Egyptians. You see, before, I guess, I listened to too many preachers that made it sound like the Old Testament was just God punching people. That God was using people, whipping boys, to solve his problems. And I didn't understand that God loved mankind. I didn't understand that he had to choose a people, the children of Israel. He chose them out. But it didn't mean that he didn't love everybody. See, that was a part that was blind to me. I thought all the time when I read these accounts of these 10 horrible plagues that came on Egypt, I thought God was taking the Egyptians and beating them, just beating them down, you know, because he didn't like them, but he liked Israel. Well, Israel was in a covenant with him, so he treated them differently than he did other people. But as I mentioned the other night, I want you to think about this. If God wanted to just go in with Moses and say, okay, Moses, we're going to deliver these people. We're going to do it before lunchtime. I'm just going to roast all of these Egyptians and we're just going to walk out of here. Could he have done it? Sure, he could have done it. Why didn't he do it? Why go through 10 plagues? Why go through all the trouble? We know what we want to do here. We want to see the Israelites delivered out. So just deliver them already. Why go to all the mess? Why go to all the trouble? And now I'm starting to see, and Pastor Dave helped me to start seeing this. When he talked about the Red Sea and how God opened up the Red Sea. And he led the children of Israel through there. And Pastor Dave said, you know, if I was one of those Egyptians and I was watching this all happen, I'd be throwing down that sword. I'd be saying, whoever that God is, I want him. Because that's the mercy of God. And it reminds me of the people on the that didn't get onto the ark when the water came down. Do you think there might have been maybe at least one of the people on the outside crying out? You see, all those years, Noah was a preacher of righteousness. Maybe someone listened. Maybe someone was just on the very edge of saying, oh, I'm gonna get in that ark. And they didn't. And that door slammed shut. Do you think in the mercy of God, if they would have cried out to him, that he would have responded? I personally believe so. And I see what happened in these 10 plagues. Before the first plague happened. Here's God dealing with Moses, little stuttering Moses. I can't do this, God. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. I'll give you Aaron. Aaron will go and he'll talk for you and he'll speak for you. He'll be your mouthpiece. And we have this image of Moses, like on the Ten Commandments, and that we watched as a kid on the, you know, on the big screen. We see Charlton Heston standing there saying, "Let my people go." And he didn't sound like that at all. Probably it was, let my people go. You see, God's not looking for the very best of the best to use. He'll use us if we'll let him. So I want to go through a few of these. I want to point out to you why it is that these plagues happened the way they did. So the first thing that we will look at in chapter 7 of Exodus. Oh, I need to point this out in chapter 4 of Exodus. Something that you see here that for most of us that have a Gentilized mind, we have no idea what this is talking about. Verse 24 of chapter 4. And it came to pass by the way in the end that the Lord met him, Moses, and he sought to kill him. That doesn't sound too good. In verse 25, Zipporah took a sharp stone, cut off the foreskin of her son, and cast it at his feet, and said, "Surely a bloody husband art thou unto me." So he let him go. Then she said, "A bloody husband thou art because of the circumcision." That's important. God's about to send Moses to deliver the children of Israel. And here Moses has failed to circumcise his son. Well, to me, that doesn't mean very much. But see, in that time period, the way he dealt with Israel, the way he dealt with them was because they would accept that cut in their foreskin and that would join them into the covenant. If it wasn't there, they weren't in. And God would go after Moses the way he did in order for him to make this cut in his son, because he knew, you've got to be in this relationship. You've got to be all in with me, Moses, and it means that you are going to circumcise your son in order for us to continue this. Today, the circumcision in the physical body, that's not what we're after. But how many of you know that there is a cut of circumcision that's been done on the inside of you, in your heart? That symbol on the outside was the foreshadowing of what happened when you became born again. When you became born again, you received the cut of circumcision on the inside. You became born again. Glory to God. Now let's go ahead and look at some more of this. So he sends in Moses, sends in Aaron. First thing we see in chapter 7, verse 8. And the Lord spake unto Moses and unto Aaron, saying, "When Pharaoh shall speak unto you, saying, show a miracle, for then thou shalt Say unto Aaron, take thy rod, cast it before Pharaoh, and it shall become a serpent. And Moses and Aaron went in unto Pharaoh, and they did so, and as the Lord had commanded. Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh and before his servants, and it became a serpent. Pharaoh also called the wise men and the sorcerers, now the magicians of Egypt. They also did in like manner with the enchantments. For they cast down every man his rod, and they became serpents. But Aaron's rod swallowed up their rods. And he hardened Pharaoh's heart, that he hearkened not unto them, as the Lord had said. So here he's got the rod of Aaron. He throws it down. It becomes a snake. So Pharaoh says, we can do that. We'll just go out and get our magicians, our sorcerers, and they're going to come in. Now, why did they have those people? Well, the Egyptians had this snake god. Who knew? Well, I think God probably knew. So the first thing that God's doing is he's showing them his superiority. He's showing them who he is. He's introducing these Egyptians to the real God. These Egyptians had all kind of gods. See, this is a thing that was blind to me for years. I didn't know how many gods these people had. They had a god for everything. They had the god of Ra. He was their sun god. They had a god of the Nile. And see, the next thing that happens, the first plague, is where the blood, or the water of all of the water in Egypt becomes blood. Now, and I wrote some of these down here, and I'm going to read a few of these to you. The water that became the blood, that's in chapter 7, verse 19. And Sobek was the Nile god. Sobek had a crocodile form. He was connected with the Nile and protected the king. Live crocodiles were kept in the pools at the temple built in honor of Sobek. All along these 10 plagues, what you're going to see is each one of them had some relationship to one of these gods. And all the time, God, the God, in his mercy, is showing these people, look, you think this Nile God is something. I'm the real God. And he turned the water into blood. And as a result, all the fish died. Everything died. There was a stench everywhere. Now, I would have thought after something, I mean, can you imagine seeing that? Seeing that on display right in front of you. Somebody goes out here to the Arkansas, the beautiful Arkansas, turns it into blood. Is that going to get your attention? Wouldn't you start wondering if maybe this God, maybe he might be the real God? And I want you to see what Pharaoh does as a result of this. In chapter 7, verse 14, in chapter 8, at the end of chapter 7, they put up with that for 7 days. And then chapter 8, verse 1, and the Lord spake unto Moses, go unto Pharaoh, and say unto him, thus saith the Lord, let my people go, that they may serve me. And if thou refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite all thy borders with frogs. And this was the second plague. And the river shall bring forth frogs abundantly, which shall go up and come into thine house and into thy bedchamber and upon thy bed. Now look at all this. And into thy house of thy servants and upon thy people and into thine ovens, into thy kneading troughs. And the frogs shall come up both on thee and upon thy people and upon thy servants. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying unto Aaron, stretch forth thine hand with thy rod over the streams, over the rivers, over the ponds, and cause frogs to come up upon the land of Egypt. And Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up and covered the land of Egypt. And the magicians, they did so with their enchantments and brought up frogs upon the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, "Entreat the Lord that he may take away the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go that they may do sacrifice unto the Lord." When shall I entreat for thee, for thy servants, and for thy people to destroy the frogs from thee and thy house, that they may remain in the river only?" Now look at this answer. Now think about this. He's asking Pharaoh, "When do you want me to do this?" Pharaoh's response, "Well, let's do it tomorrow." Now think about that. That's just ludicrous. These frogs are everywhere. And his response was, "We'll wait till tomorrow and do this. We'll spend one more night with the frogs." That's just crazy. And then you see in verse 13, "And the Lord, according to the words of Moses, the frogs died. Out of the houses, out of the villages, out of the fields, they gathered them together upon heaps, and the land stank. But when Pharaoh saw that there was a respite, he hardened his heart. He hearkened not unto them, as the Lord had said." In verse 16, "And the Lord said unto Moses, say unto Aaron, stretch out thy rod and smite the dust." Now think about that. How much dust is there in Egypt? Every little dust granule is going to become lice. Lice. So it wasn't bad enough that all the water everywhere, not just in the rivers, but even in their pots at home, all of the water became blood. That wasn't bad enough. They made frogs. Frogs were everywhere. Frogs were in their bed. Frogs were in their ovens. Frogs were everywhere. They had a frog god. Apparently the frog god wasn't really cutting it for them. They had frogs everywhere. How many more nights? "When do you want me to get rid of the frogs?" "Well, why don't you do that tomorrow? Let the people go." "No, not going to let them go." "All right, take that rod over all the dust of Egypt, all of the dust. Think about this. All of the dust becomes lice everywhere. Now I'm thinking to myself, I'm hard-headed, but that's just nuts. That you're not going to say, "Okay, I give up. You're the God. I recognize that. But you know what? He didn't do it. He wouldn't do it." So let's go on here. Verse 18, "The magicians did so." See, the magicians, now they're going to try to do just like they did before. Just like with the water turned to blood, just like with the frogs, the magicians are going to try and do something and to produce the lice. And look what it says. "The magicians did so with their enchantments to bring forth lice, but they could not. So there were lice upon man and upon beast. The magicians said unto Pharaoh," they're becoming believers, "this is the finger of God." Do you see something here? You see, if God would have just roasted all of them from the beginning, said, we're going to get these guys out. We're going to get Israel out of here. We're just going to roast all of them and release them. These people wouldn't have had that kind of an encounter. These magicians, they wouldn't be sitting there saying, this is really the finger of God. See what's happening? In the mercy of God. These people, they're beginning to see something that they've never saw before. Why am I going to this great extent to do this? Because I want you to stop looking at God like He's your problem. He ain't your problem. He loves you with a love that would cause Jesus to go to the extents of becoming one of us. He's not your problem. He didn't come here to judge you. He came here to be judged in your place. The judgment was prolonged from the first Adam all the way until the last Adam came on the scene. And the last Adam became the door through his death. He became the door. Somebody had to do it. We weren't qualified because we weren't righteous. He is righteous. He became the door. He's not our problem. He loves us. He wasn't trying to beat the Egyptians up just to show us something. He was extending mercy to them. Let's go on here. And the Lord said unto Moses, and this is going to point out something here. Verse 20 of chapter 8. We're going into the fourth plague of the flies. And the Lord said unto Moses, rise up early in the morning. That's important. You see, the morning time was a sacred time for them with their gods. They believed that at night, one god ate the other god, and then in the morning, a new god would rise up. They were crazy. So here we're talking about in the morning. This is a sacred time. And you might already know this, but the Pharaoh, they looked at as godlike. And he's telling him in the morning time, rise up early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh. Lo, he cometh forth to the water, and say unto him, thus saith the Lord, let my people go, that they may serve thee. Why is that important? We're going to this is going to be the fourth plague. Fourth plague. And Pharaoh is still going to worship his false god. Do you think he's even close to seeing the real God for who he is? No, he's not. And so it continues. We're going to have a god of the flies on the scene here. He's going to send this plague of flies. Say unto him, thus saith the Lord, let my people go that they may serve me. Else, if thou wilt not let my people go, behold, I will send swarms of flies upon thee and upon thy servants and upon thy people and into thy houses, and the houses of the Egyptians shall be full, say full, full of swarms of flies, and also the ground whereon they are. And I will sever in that day, now look at this, the land of Goshen, that's where the Israelites were at. I'm going to sever them in which my people dwell, that the swarms of flies shall not be there to the end. Thou mayest know that I am the Lord in the midst of the earth. And I will put a division between my people and thy people. Tomorrow shall this sign be. So he comes up with the swarms of the flies. In Pharaoh, the end of that chapter, Pharaoh hardened his heart. Wasn't going to let him go. In chapter 9, we see the fifth plague, the plague where the cattle were plagued and they died. And he said, thus saith the Lord God of the Hebrews, let my people go that they may serve me. For if thou refuse to let them go, I wilt hold them still. Behold, the hand of the Lord is upon thy cattle, which is in thy field, and upon thy horses, upon thy asses, upon the camels, upon the oxen, upon the sheep. And there will be a very grievous murrain, that's a plague. And the Lord shall sever between the cattle of Israel and the cattle of Egypt. And there shall nothing die of that is the children of Israel. There was a cattle god. There was another god. See, it wasn't just that he was arbitrarily going through and doing these things. There's a reason for it. All the years, nobody ever pointed this out to me. Nobody ever said, you know, this is why God did what he did. He turned the water into blood for a reason. There was a God of the Nile. He did all of these different things. We're at the one with the cattle. The next thing, there's going to be boils. There was a goddess of ice called Isis. This goddess, she was the goddess of healing. All these things were happening. They were trying. God was trying to get them to see the fallacy of what they believed in. I'm going to skip a few here. The fifth one was the cattle dying. The sixth one was the boils. I'm going to read a verse here in chapter 9, verse 14. Let me read 13. And the Lord said unto Moses, rise up early in the morning. There we go again. And stand before Pharaoh and say unto him, thus saith the Lord God of the Hebrews, let my people go that they may serve me. For I will at this time send all my plagues upon thine heart and upon thy servants and upon thy people, that thou mayest know that there is none like me in all the earth. He wanted them to realize this. God wanted them to realize, I'm God. Wake up. How many more things am I going to have to do to show you who the real God is? The seventh plague was the plague of the hail. The eighth plague was the plague of locusts. There's actually little, they found this as they dug the ruins up. There's little trinkets of locusts. There's little trinkets of flies. These are the things that they worshipped. So the eighth plague was the locusts. The ninth plague, if you'll look at chapter 10, verse 21. And we're getting to the part that will paint this whole picture for you. Chapter 10, verse 21. The Lord said unto Moses, stretch out thine hand toward heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, even darkness which may be felt. And Moses stretched forth his hand toward heaven, and there was thick darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. When Jesus died on the cross, do you recall that there was darkness? Do you remember how long that darkness was? 3 hours. Do you think there's any kind of a correlation here? The darkness here with the darkness that he experienced. The darkness of spiritual death. Moses stretched forth his hand toward heaven, and there was thick darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. They saw not one another, neither rose any from his place for 3 days. But all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. Pharaoh called unto Moses and said, go you serve the Lord. Only let your flocks and your herds, let them stay here. Let your little ones also go with you. And Moses said, thou must give us also sacrifices and burnt offerings, that we may sacrifice unto the Lord our God. Our cattle also shall go with us. There shall not a hoof be left behind, for therefore must we take this in to serve the Lord our God. And we know not with what we must serve the Lord until we come thither. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let them go. And Pharaoh said unto him, get thee from me. Take heed to thyself. See my face no more, for in the day thou seest my face, thou shalt surely die. And Moses said, thou hast spoken well. I will see thy face again no more. Now the last plague, number 10, is the plague that I've been wanting to get to. Turn over, hold your place here. I want you to turn over. I want you to see this in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Flip over there. We'll be looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Looking at verses 6 through 8. Just to give you a little idea of what's happening in this chapter 5. The first verse kind of gives you the whole picture. It's reported commonly there's fornication among you, such as fornication is not so much as named among the Gentiles, that one should have his father's wife. That's what's going on here. In verse 6, it says, your glorying is not good. Know you not that a little leaven leaveneth the whole lump? Purge out, therefore, the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, and you are unleavened. You are unleavened. You know, that kind of a statement right there, you could read right past it and not have any idea what that just said. you are unleavened. The leaven here is the leaven, that sin nature, the sin. He's saying you are unleavened. There is no sin nature in you. That's gone. You are unleavened. Purge out that old leaven. For even Christ, now look at this, our Passover is sacrificed for us. The judgment. The judgment that I was talking about earlier. The judgment. He was the one sacrificed. He didn't come here to judge us. You know those times that you feel so condemned? That's not God. God's not the one condemning you. Now, when you do things wrong, there's going to be conviction that's going to come out of your new nature. That's good. Don't silence that. Just repent when you make the mistakes. But the condemnation, that's not God. He didn't come here to judge us. He came here to become the judgment himself, to take it in himself. That's the Passover lamb. That's what happened in the 10th plague. Let's go back there. Go back and look at this in Exodus chapter 11. See, this is Jesus becoming the door of John chapter 10 in the Passover. And look at how clearly this is written. This is so exciting to me. I can tell you're excited too. Chapter 11. And the Lord said unto Moses, yet will I bring one plague more upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterwards, he will let you go hence. When he shall let you go, he shall surely thrust you out. He's not just going to let you go. He's going to kick you in the behind. He's going to push you out. Speak now in the ears of the people, and let every man borrow of his neighbor and every woman of her neighbor jewels of silver, jewels of gold. I want you to think about this. Now, we've gone through 9 plagues. And these people are going to go and talk to the Egyptians and say, here, can we borrow something from? Are you kidding me? You're the reason for the flies. You're the reason for the frogs. And guess what they did? They gave it to them. The Israelites plundered the Egyptians. Plundered them. Look at what it says in the Lord, verse 3. Gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Now, I'm not a rocket scientist, but I've got to wonder here when I read this, if this isn't telling me something about the wealth that I should be walking in right now. If this is a picture of the Passover, of the Israel walking out of Egypt, of me walking out of the world, me being delivered into this place of sonship, I think there's got to be something here about the plundering, about the wealth. I think it says this somewhere, of the world being laid up for the just. We're operating so far below what we should, what's rightfully ours. We're operating so far below it. Why is that, Mark? Well, you know, Gary had that picture, that little flame, just a little flicker, and gas being poured on it. Do you know what happens when a gas gets poured on just even the smallest flicker of a flame? Poof! See, that flicker is the strongholds that are yet on the inside of us. It's not that God doesn't want to pour out the wealth on us. It's that we haven't yet come to the place where we're not full of the strongholds, where a little gas isn't going to blow up into some inferno inside of us. But we're getting there. We are getting there. And there'll be a time whenever he will pour out, and that wealth will come and flow through our hands. I can assure you of that, because that is going to be crucial for this last day revival. Now, you might sit there and think, I don't really believe in the last day. Well, you can believe or you don't have to believe, but it's going to happen. And it's going to happen in this place. And I would suggest that you do whatever you need to do to be preparing for that. Because it is happening. Let me finish up here. Verse 4 of chapter 11. And Moses said, "Thus saith the Lord, about midnight will I go out into the midst of Egypt." I want you to look at this. Verse 5, chapter 11. "And all," say all "the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die. For the firstborn of Pharaoh that sitteth upon his throne, even unto the firstborn of the maidservants that's behind the mill, and all the firstborn of beast. And there shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as there was none like it, nor shall be like it any more. But against any of the children of Israel shall not a dog move his mouth against man or beast, that he may know how that the Lord doth put a difference between Egyptians and Israel." That firstborn, I want to refer back to a vision that Gary had. He said when he saw Jesus hanging on that cross, and he saw at that second all of humanity laid dead. The firstborn of Egypt. Anyone of those Egyptians that didn't do what was told here to do, the firstborn died. What's that a picture of? That's a picture of the death of the first Adam. That's what it is. The first Adam, the death of the first Adam, the firstborn. I've told you before, it says that in Luke, the Adam, the Son of God. This is the picture of the first Adam, his death. Anybody that wasn't protected when that death angel went through Egypt, dead, firstborn, dead. That's the picture. Well, let's read this. Chapter 12. "And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, This month shall be unto you the beginning of months, shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak you unto all the congregation of Israel, saying, In the tenth day of this month, they shall take to them every man a lamb, according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for a house. And if the household be too little for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next unto his house take it according to the number of the souls. Every man according to his eating shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You shall take it out from the sheep or from the goats, and you shall keep it up until the 14th day of the same month, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it in the evening." And now look at this. "And they shall take of the blood and strike it on the two sides, side post, and upon the upper post, upper door post of the houses wherein they shall eat it." Where are they going to put it? Did it say a door? Sure did. Set a door. Here it is. Here it is under the shadow. There had to be a door. There had to be a door. And here's the door. He said, "Take the blood of the Passover lamb. Strike it on the side post. Strike it across the top of it." And what are they going to do once they do that? They're going to go through the door. They're going to go inside. What's inside? What's that a picture of? You're walking out of that old person and in to the new person. The family of God, a reborn child of God. That's what you're walking into. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. He told us in John chapter 10, he showed it to us under the shadow. Under the shadow, one of the plagues, the Passover. Let's read the rest of this. Verse 8. "And they shall eat the flesh in that night, roast it with fire and unleavened bread. and with bitter herbs they shall eat it. I'll stop right there. I want to explain this to you. Why would they roast it with bitter herbs? The bitter herbs represent the sin that was laid upon Jesus. The unleavened bread, the sinless Jesus that was made sin by laying the herbs on the lamb, that was the symbol of the sin being laid upon Jesus. The unleavened bread is the picture of Him never having sinned, never sinning. And yet the roasting of the herbs on the lamb is the picture of the sin being laid upon Him. What did they do? They ate of the lamb. When you eat something, what happens? Have you ever looked, you ever eat a carrot and you look at your arm and say, oh, that's where that carrot is. You ate a nice big fat steak. Yeah, I see it. It's right there on my left arm. You don't do that. Why is that? Because it assimilates in your body. It becomes you, who you are. You become one with that food. So you take of this, He's telling them, take of this lamb, you eat of it, you're going to become one with Me. Take of that unleavened bread. See, the bread, you remember when we have a communion, do this in remembrance of Me. You have the bread, you have the wine. Those aren't just, we didn't just come up with that. They're symbols of a covenant. The covenant that now exists between Jesus and the Father. That unleavened bread, that the little wafers are hard. We don't use unleavened bread here, but I remember as a kid, you'd chew on them hard little wafers. Yuck. Didn't like that. But you're becoming one. You're becoming one with Him. That's what that's about. So you walk inside. You walk through the doorway. Here you are, just this little Israelite. You painted this blood over here. You really don't even know why you're doing it. You're just doing it because Moses said to do it. Okay, kill the lamb. Let's put the blood up here and walk inside. We're inside. Nobody inside died. The firstborn, He tells us later, the firstborn on the inside, I want you to sanctify that firstborn. Because that's the picture of the last Adam, the firstborn from the dead. That's what that's a picture of. The firstborn on the outside dying, the firstborn on the inside being sanctified. You're on the inside. You're not partway in and partway out. You don't have one leg in and one leg out. You are either in or you're out. If you're out, when you die and you stand in front of the judgment seat of Christ, He's going to pass judgment and you're going to spend eternity in hell. I trust that nobody in here is in that position. But because we're on the inside, because we have allowed that blood, we have walked through that doorway that He created in Himself, and we have become children of the living God. You're His child. You're on the inside. That's where you are. That's who you are now. He wants us to recognize who we are. You don't have to try to be this way. It's who you are. You are His son. You are His child. Don't try. Just be. Just be this person. Well, how do you do that? I feel so condemned all the time. I don't feel like I measure up. That's not you. That's not coming out of your new nature. Your new nature knows who you are. It's the part that's yet been transformed. That's where your problem is. Transform. Do what we teach you to do. Find out who you are. Because you are victorious. You're more than a conqueror. There's nothing that the enemy has that can defeat you. Nothing. Nothing. There's no sickness. There's no disease. There's nothing. Poverty can't defeat you. Nothing can defeat you. I know it's hard to believe, but it's the truth. Nothing. You have been redeemed. I want to show you one last thing and then I'm going to stop. Go back. Go back here to Exodus chapter 6. I want you to see this. And then I'll stop. Exodus chapter 6. Beginning in verse 1. Then the Lord said unto Moses, Now shalt thou see what I will do to Pharaoh, for with a strong hand shall he let them go, with a strong hand shall he drive them out of his land. And God spake unto Moses and said unto him, I am the Lord. And I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob by the name of God Almighty. But by my name, Jehovah, was I not known to them. And I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, wherein they were strangers. And I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians kept in bondage. And I have remembered my covenant. Why did he change? He said, I talked to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob. I introduced myself to them as God. But I'm going to introduce myself to you as Jehovah. You'll find in scriptures, and you can go on the internet and just call this up. All I did was type in to the search engine, 7 redemptive names of God. And got this real nice one piece of paper with the 7 redemptive names of God. I would suggest you do. It's pretty good. First one is Jehovah Jireh. He's telling these people, this is who you're in covenant with. Jehovah Jireh, the one that provides everything. Jehovah Rapha, Lord that heals. Jehovah Nisi, the Lord our banner. Jehovah Shalom, the Lord our peace. Jehovah Rapha, the Lord, my shepherd. You know, that refers back to Psalm 23. Jehovah is my shepherd and I shall not want. Jehovah Sitkenu, the Lord, is my righteousness. Jehovah Shammah, the Lord, is present. He introduced himself. He said, here, this is who I am. I am your peace. I am your healer. I am your banner. I am your protector. I am your provider. I'm everything to you. That's who he wants to be to us. He wants to be everything to us. Not just the reason why we go to heaven. He wants to be everything to you right now, today. Today. What do you need? Do you have a lack of peace? He's your peace. Do you have a lack of provision? It's because you don't know him as your provider. Are you sick? Do you need healing? He's your healer. See, Jesus came, fulfilled it all on the cross. What he introduced himself as right there through the 7 redemptive names when he died on that cross, it was ratified in his body. He became this to us. And we became provided for, healed, at peace. If you're not at peace, it's simply because you haven't allowed him to become your peace. Because he's done it all. He's done it all. Glory to God. Well, I hope you received something from that. I hope you did. If you will stand with me. You say, Mark, when is this going to really matter to me? Well, I guess it's whenever you're getting your brains beat out and you're trying to figure out why it is that you feel the way you do. Why it is that you allow the enemy to condemn you the way you do. Maybe then you'll start to realize, hey, I have stepped through that doorway. I'm not the same person that I used to be. I've changed. That devil has no right tormenting my mind. I have peace available to me. He wants you to live in peace. He wants you. His plan for you is total victory. His plan for you is that you will never want, that you will never lack, that you'll never be in sickness. But you say, but that's the story of my life. It doesn't have to stay that way. It does not have to stay that way. Well, how is it going to change? It's going to change as you begin to believe who you've become, who He's made you. As you begin to believe it, just simply believe. But that's too easy. I feel like I believe it already. You believe it in your head, but not in your heart. That's the only thing it could be. You have a mental assent to what you think is right. But is it alive in your heart? If it is alive in your heart, you'll see the evidence in your life. It's as simple as that. And if it's not there, if that revelation is not there, you're not going to see any evidence in your life of it. Can't be. You can't have it both ways. So as we close today, if there's anybody here that needs prayer, I would like you to come forward. If you're struggling in the area of peace, if you are fighting it in your mind, you know, I can pray with you. Debbie and I can pray together with you and pray for grace. Grace to help you to get in to the prayer closet and to walk out of it. You don't have to stay there. It's not going to be just one person's prayer. It's going to be you getting yourself in there and praying and changing.